This is an interview being conducted on October 23rd, 2009 by Nancy Peroso with Mr. Bert Domes in his house on Monty Hall
Drive
in Winnipeg, Manitoba. So I'd like to start the interview by asking Mr. Domes to introduce himself a little bit more broadly, and since I already know that he grew up on a farm, just to tell us a little bit about his life in the early years on the Saskatchewan farm.
I grew up in, well, wait a minute, did you cut that off?
Okay, we can cut anything out, so don't worry about
it. My name is Bernard Arnold Domes.
Oh.
I go by B-A-D, Bad. And anyway, I was born in on the farm at Yellowgrass, Saskatchewan. I guess it was Section 2, Township 10, Range 16, west of the Second Meridian. And of course, I was brought into this world by a midwife. And well, we stayed, I guess we moved from one farm to the other when I was just a little baby. I think about 2 or 3 months old, or maybe less than that. We lived on the farm for, well, we went to school in Yellowgrass, first of all, at a local school outside of town. You know, it was a country school. Then for the high school education, went into Yellowgrass. And, of course, stayed on the farm. My father needed help on there, so we stayed there for quite a while. And then my mother got ill, and they had to go to the States several times a year to get medical help. So the wife and I, after we got married, farmed the land, and we had some land of our own. And this, we stayed there for, I guess, about 3 years. And then we had 1 year, I think it was 1951, frost came along and froze our crop. So we thought we better do something else. And that's when we decided to go into the grain business.
Just to go back a little bit then, was your father the original homesteader on the farm that you were born on?
Well, he was not a homesteader on that land. No, he farmed at one time just south of Yellowgrass. And then this land come up for sale, and of course they bought this section of land.
And where was his family from?
His family, well, they moved from, well, he came in from England, I guess that's where he came from. And his wife was, of course, my grandmother. But they came, I think she came from the Ukraine one time. Yeah. And this was back in 1800s, whatever year, I forget. But, like, my mother was born in the Northwest Territories, which was at Yellowgrass, and she was born on the farm in the same house that I was born, of course. And what else should I say about that?
Was it a large farm?
Section of land.
At that time, quite a large.
One section. Well, I guess, yeah, it was. It was probably the average sized farm at that time.
Mm-hmm. Did your dad ever tell stories about what it was like when, way back when, in his early days?
Oh, probably he did. No, he did tell us about, you know, what Yellowgrass was like at one time. And, you know, they had a drugstore, they had a doctor, and they had three or four livery stables, and you know, they had grocery stores and a tinsmith and two blacksmith shops, and you know, there was it was a going concern, and a jewelry shop besides.
Now, I'm completely ignorant of where Yellowgrass is in relation to some of the bigger centers in Saskatchewan.
Well, if you know of Regina.
Oh, yes.
Or Weyburn, Saskatchewan.
Mm-hmm.
We're about 18 miles, I guess, northwest of Weyburn, and about 54 miles southeast of Regina.
Okay.
Yeah.
So southern part of the province then.
Southern part of the province.
Close to the American border?
Oh, yes, we'd be about 50-some miles, I suppose, to the border.
Mm-hmm. So the frost took one of your crops. and you realized what a risky business this farming was.
You know, when you go back and think about it, my wife, the wife and I, we walked through our field that on August the 4th, and it was one of the most beautiful crops you'd ever want to look at. As a matter of fact, a lot of people wouldn't even recognize grain like wheat filling 8 rows, and generally it's 4 or 6 row. 6 row would be classified as a pretty good crop, but this was filling 8 row. And that night, and August the 4th of that evening, it froze, and that the grain actually stank in the farm, on the field.
Now, even though I'm not a farmer, August the 4th seems like an awfully early frost.
That was an early frost that year.
Now, a lot of people who would be listening to this conversation won't necessarily know what you mean by filling 8 rows. They would be thinking you're talking about rows in the ground, but I think it's something else, is it?
Well, they would. You know, how would you classify 8 rows? You know, you have a head of grain,
mm-hmm.
and then the kernels would be formed around the grain. Whether
yes.
it's 2 row, 6 row, or whatever, and this would be 8 rows around the circle up
to
the top.
Oh, wow. So a really good yield then.
It would have been a tremendous yield.
Oh. Yeah. Complete loss with frost?
Well, yeah, the old conventional one-ton trucks at that time would carry about a good grain, about 100 bushels of grain. We combined it, and you could get about 34 bushels on there. In the truck, so you can imagine the extent of damage.
Yeah. What year would this have been, do you recall?
That was 1951.
I think you said that, 1951. What was life on the farm like then from the standpoint of machinery? You mentioned the truck.
Oh, the machinery at that time, I guess probably maybe a lot of people had, but they had tractors already. And they were McCormick Durings, 10W20 and 1530. That's what the size of the machine was. But, there were other machines too. There was, you know, Cockshots and Case and Massey Harris. There was all kinds of them.
Mm-hmm. So, once you decided to move into a different area of the grain trade,
that's
because farming
exactly.
sure is a
yeah, area. That's when we decided that we would enter the grain industry. So I took up employment with the Sask Wheat Pool. And
were all of the companies represented at Yellowgrass, or was it...
There was, I guess there, at that time there was the Pool, Patterson's, Searle, Pioneer. It could have been Western at that time, but Pioneer and United Grain Growers. And it wasn't United Grain Growers at the time either. It was McCabe Grain.
Ah, okay.
So there's 5 elevators in town, 5 different companies.
Right. Interesting you say that, because yesterday we finished an interview with Richard Croft, who was is Charlie Croft's son.
Yeah, Charlie Croft.
And he was talking about the buyout of McCabe's by
Grain Growers.
Grain Growers, or National first and then Grain Growers. I'm not quite sure whether there was sort of a quick two-step there.
Well, I don't know. I thought probably perhaps that United Grain Growers bought McCabe's out directly.
Okay. Yeah, I'm no expert, so don't rely on me.
That would be, that probably be after I left there.
Mm-hmm. So you went to the Pool for
About a year and a half. And
and what did you do there?
Well, of course, I was learning the trade of buying grain. And, of course, I thought I maybe knew grain pretty well at that time. So, anyway, we went from one station to another. They promised a station and that you could have on your own, but well, anyway, I had took some stations over that were Farrell had to go for an operation or whatever. He wasn't there for 4 or 5 months or whatever. So anyway, I handled a lot of grain for them, but from one station to the other, it just seemed that they promised you something and they wouldn't come through with it.
Mm-hmm.
But in this one station, I went to one of the later ones and got into the elevator and tried to start it up. And of course, it was run by small gasoline engines. This one was in particular. So we get in there to try to start it up, go down, and I find out that the belts were torn apart, or actually the rats chewed the lacing out of the belts. So first thing you knew, you have to lace the belt to get the machinery going. And then, of course, you try to put the elevator into gear, so to speak, with a clutch to take it in and out of gear, and find out that's rusted shut. So anyway, then you learn to start the engine or the elevator by, when you started the engine, you had to start the whole elevator. And that was a jack shaft from the engine over to the other side of the under the office, the gangplank they call it, and then was another jack shaft and another belt going into the elevator, and it was run by rope shivs. They were big long wheels with ropes to drive the ropes up to the top of the elevator to elevate the grain. So you get down there, and first thing you know, when you get the engine started, it plugged up, and I just running it a little too fast, and it plugged up. So they have two inspection holes on either side of the leg, the elevating leg.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to put a trouble light in there, and it only went down about 2 feet, and it was full of dust and grain. And this, the rope, the pulley, I guess rope shivs you'd call it, it was just creating a path in the dust. That's where it was running. So anyway, we got a fella out of the country to come in, and I think we took 3 truckloads of stuff out of the pits to get that cleaned up.
Hmm.
And of course, in the meantime, I already had the clutch fixed up. And
so not everybody was good at maintaining their operation or their housekeeping.
They sure weren't looking after their elevators, that's for sure not. Hmm. And anyway, one of the fellows out of the district, he was hauling grain one day, and in fact, he was the director of the pool. He was hauling grain this day, and there was a real strong wind from the southeast. And he came in and dumped his grain, and he said, Domes, he said, you better get oil on them rollers, that old barn track rollers. And he said, get that fixed up. I said, I beg your pardon. I said, there's an oil can in the basement of the engine room. I said, if you want to oil them, you go ahead and oil them. I was getting kind of fed up at that time having to fix all this machinery. And not that wasn't the first elevator I had to do that with either. But so then Mr. Bob Pringle out of Regina called me one day, and he said, I want you to go to Esalen, Saskatchewan. He said, the man down there is had a hernia operation or something, and he said he won't be able to work for about 4, 5, 6 months. I said, is there any living accommodations? And all, he said, no. He said, you can, he said, I understand you can have a half-ton truck. You can load yourself up, put a big couch to sleep on. He said, you take a loaf of bread and some sausage or something. That's exactly what he said. Well, I said, if that's the best you got, they had already promised me an elevator a couple of times, but things come up that they needed somebody to look after these stations. And anyway, I said, I'll tell you what, I guess maybe that's the end of our association. So I quit just like that. And then I went to Patterson's.
Which elevator were you at the time that you left the pool then?
Well, I suppose it would be my hometown, Yellow Grass.
Okay.
A fellow by the name of Kennedy, of course, Earl Kennedy, he was the manager one time. And I don't know whether he ever come back, it just so long ago, I don't know whether he come back or whether somebody took over.
Mm.
But yeah, that was there. I helped out at Wilcox, Royston, McTaggart, and Weyburn for them, okay. 4 different places. And handled a lot of grain at each location, too.
Yeah. I'd like to come back to talk about the grain handling and something that you mentioned earlier, but before I do, I've just been reading a book by a fellow, and I cannot remember his last name, but his nickname is Bing. And he used to construct elevators in Saskatchewan, all over the place. Ring a bell at all?
Bing.
And it was around the time that you were...
No, not
yeah.
Bing. I don't recall.
Too bad I can't remember his last name, and I can't recall either. You know, who he's building for. Probably the pool, but I'm not sure.
Not a ByQuest, no.
All over the province. He just traveled from place to place, you know, fixing up these problems you're talking about.
Bing.
And he found them in quite disarray as well.
So, no, I don't recall anybody by the name of Bing.
Yeah. Well, if I think about it, I'll send you his full name. Because I have the book on my bedside table,
okay.
So I'll have a
good
look at it. You might even enjoy the book. It's just his reminiscences of probably starting in the 1930s of going from place to place in Saskatchewan, building and repairing the primary elevators. One of the things that you mentioned, just at the time you were talking about leaving the farm and taking a job with the pool as a buyer, you said, I thought I knew a lot about grain. What did you learn early in those early days that you didn't know as a farmer?
I think maybe it just come naturally.
Mm-hmm.
Just come naturally.
So the skills you had as being a farm boy.
Well, of course, yeah. But other than that, I mean, you know, when you got into your first location that I assisted, which was at Wilcox, Saskatchewan, the guy was pretty good at, you know, showing me various things.
And what would you have to watch for?
Well, it was all mostly visual. Visual for quality. You had your scales for testing for weight, for example. And you had equipment to assess dockage. I recall at Wilcox, they had to test for moisture. We had the old Brown Duval moisture testers where you cooked the grain in oil. And then it would take, it would take around about 3/4 of an hour to cook this grain. And then you'd have to let it cool. Of course, it would, as you cooked it, the moisture would drop out into a container. And then it would take about 20 minutes to cool. And that's when it cooled, that's when the moisture would drip into a container. And it would tell you exactly what moisture content there was in the grain.
So when a farmer came in with a load then, what kinds of tests did you have to do, or was it largely visual? When would you have to do this longer?
Well, mostly visual. You know, if you looked at the grain and felt the grain and you felt that it was pretty, and it had good weight, and then you'd have to just visually determine what grade you were going to place on it. You know, there was various factors, of course, I guess, in the grading of the grain. There was mildew, there was starch, and whatever.
And was it an easy process to agree with the farmer as to what the the grade should be?
Well, they had an idea, too, of course. And the grain trade was a very competitive industry. So you couldn't be too wrong in grading your grain.
Or they'd go to?
The opposition. For sure.
Now, did I ask this? So when you moved to Patterson then, it was Patterson in Yellowgrass?
Patterson was in Yellowgrass, yes.
Yeah. And what happened there? What was your...
What happened there? Well, anyway, I started off with the Aussie Barkwell. He was the agent. They called him agents at that time. Stayed with him for a while, and then right away they asked me to go to Woodrow, Saskatchewan. So I went over there. The guy apparently went on holidays, and he never did come back, as a matter of fact. But anyway, we stayed there for a couple of weeks or whatever. And from there, we come back, and then they wanted me to go to, I believe it was Whitewood, Saskatchewan, or maybe Lumsden first. Lumsden, and this guy was going to go on vacation too, Lloyd Gerson. And that was, of course, the elevator was run by diesel engine.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to equate yourself with the starting of this thing, too, because if you didn't have enough air in the tank, it'd start with pressure, open the valve on the tank, and the air would kick the engine into gear and we should go. Eh? But if that was run out of air, you'd have to start with your foot. You get into the rungs of the flywheels, and you'd get it started, of course. But anyway, I think I was there about 2 weeks, and farmers were hauling grain over a valley, which had a bridge in it, and it was going to wash out, and they were serious about that, so they were hauling grain till 12 o'clock at night. And then you have to load cars during the day and do everything else. But I think that week and a week and a half, I think I handled about 60,000 bushels of grain. Farmers were just hauling and hauling and
nonstop.
Of course, nonstop. At that time, of course, we were able to get cars to ship it out right away too. But from there, either it was Wilcox but Whitewood or Lumsden. But then the district manager out there in that area, he approached me and he said, "We want you to take an elevator." And then we went to Coppell, Saskatchewan. We were there from, what was it, Joe, 1953 to 57, about 4 years, a little over 4 years. And then I was asked to come to Winnipeg to be a district manager for the Winnipeg Territory. And 4 years after that, I went into the office.
Hmm.
And I took a training as to what was going on in the office.
So you must have been really pleased, both of you, to actually have a place that you didn't have to move out of in a couple of weeks.
Well, yes, for sure. We were like at Coppell for 4 years. And then, of course, come back here into Winnipeg. Of course, that was something else. We got a house, and of course, I was on the road for 4 years.
Mm-hmm. So, what was it like? Being an elevator manager of your own in a community. What were your living accommodations like? What were the how do you establish connections in the in the community, anything you can.
Well, we had our company, Patterson's, of course, they furnished homes for their managers. At that time they did. I guess it's changed now, but they did at that time. And the homes that they provided their managers were real good homes. And so anyway, you at that time, and as a matter of fact, part of your salary, I guess they gave us a home free of rent. But later on, the government changed regulations where you either had to declare it as income at a reasonable rate of rent, and then they had to start charging rent. But the homes were good. But being in the community, of course, you get involved in the various activities in the community. When I took over Patterson's down in Coppell, the fella that had run the elevator, and apparently he wasn't too honest of a guy, I guess, maybe in dealing with, because we had a coal business there too, and things of that nature, and of course it was a requirement to make wayovers in the elevators every so often, and I guess things didn't work out. And they fired him, of course, and then I took over from that situation. And it wasn't a very pleasant situation to take over, because he had a lot of friends in that district. But we survived, and we built the business up. At that time, of course, there was, in Coppell, there was the Lake of the Woods, Patterson's, National Grain, and the pool, the four elevators. And of course, again, it was competitive. And besides, at that time, of course, the availability of boxcars to ship your grain forward. They had a kind of a more or less a an ordering system from the Canadian Wheat Board. You know, they give you a number that you'd, so you could get some X number of cars or whatever. And most of the time I was congested totally, and you couldn't get enough cars to build up your business.
Hmm.
So anyway, at one particular time, this happened, and I had, I think, L50 orders, or I forget the numbers anymore, but they had a number to it. So anyway, I was supposed to get several cars, and all of a sudden they were all train come in and spotted them all at the pool elevator. So anyway, I called my district manager up at the time, Mr. Randy Anderson, and I said, you better come to Coupelle because I'll need you. I said, what we're going to do here, seemingly this agent is supporting the pool more than the rest of us. And I said, we're going to have to put in the car order book. If we want some cars, that's what we'll do. And of course, the CPR shunned on anybody trying to put in the car order book.
Now, what does that mean, in the car
you'd
order
go,
book?
We would go right directly to the railway and or to the commission or wherever, and we say, we want car, X number of cars. That's it. We just put an order in. It was a safety,
safety mechanism
program,
I
guess you would call it, for anybody that thought maybe that he wasn't getting the just deal out of the car. Mm-hmm. However, we got down there, and when the district manager and myself went over to the railway agent, and you know, he changed his tune pretty fast, of course, and then we were able to get cars after that.
Yeah. The interviews that we're doing, I think a lot of them tend to be pretty sanitized as far as, you know, what goes on in various areas. And, you know, was there much of this sort of favoritism or money changing hands under the table?
Well, I don't think there was money changing hands. Mm-hmm. I think it was just, you know, the Sasquatch Pool, of course, they were one of the bigger grain companies, of course, in the province. And I guess some of the people were cooperative-minded.
Mm.
And probably that had something to do with it. But that certainly wasn't too extensive, I'm sure.
Yeah, it not a usual case. No. This was an unusual case.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and you can block that out of here, too, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. But that's the way it was. And, you know, it was difficult to improve your business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody got the cars, they had the space, they could take in more grain.
And that's what I'm learning about this during this project. It's very, that whole transportation issue is a very complicated issue.
Oh, yes, it did. It became more so after a while, you know, with the Canadian Wheat Board being involved with the, you know, the distribution of orders. And they had various programs, of course, and every company didn't agree with what was, you know, what program we should have. And it over, by and large, they favored the pools, the Wheat Board. Sure they did. And I'm sure that if we could have had more freeway in the way and in the acquiring of cars, to free our system up, we could have done much better. Okay.
Just asking a question about, since we're talking about the Wheat Board, and I understand just from general knowledge that the Wheat Board had quota systems where looking at their orders and letting farmers know when they could deliver certain grains, I imagine wheat usually, to be delivered to the elevators in order to supply the terminals and the ships. That quota system, how did it impact on your workload, if at all?
Well, the quota system, of course, each farmer was it was necessary each farmer to get a permit book, and he had in that permit book he outlined the amount of land he farmed, and the acreages ceded to the various grains, and of course then the weed board come in, and of course they assigned quotas to the various grains when they could be delivered, or I suppose it all related to the sales they were making. And then they were, each farmer, of course, say for example, if he had 100 acres seeded to spring wheat, and if it was a quota of 3 bushel an acre, he could deliver, you know, 300 bushels. But that's the way it went. And
were you aware the calls were coming so that you could prepare, or did it really make any difference?
It didn't make any difference, really. No, it didn't make any difference. You were able to take the grain as they opened the quotas, if there was enough space, of course. But it really didn't impact on mm-hmm. on your buying ability to, you know, to buy more grain. Mm-hmm.
Storage space in the elevators.
Well, that was another thing, of course, you know, storage space. That, you know, we had annexes to the elevator for storage, and some of that grain stayed in there for years. We never moved. And that's what it was all about. It was just elevator companies. They were paid storage by the weed board.
So you could make money off of it sitting there, you'd prefer it not to be.
No, we could make more money. We could make more money handling grain, not storing. Mm-hmm. No, we weren't in the storage business. We were in the handling business. But, you know, if you had the grain there and you couldn't move it, we were getting something to look after it. And if you didn't look after it, of course, if you bought it for a certain grade, and if that grain went bad in the storage bins and you shipped it out, you'd have to take the loss.
And what would cause something to go bad in the storage bins?
Well, grain beetles, rusty grain beetle, for example. You know, they'd come, you know, they... if it got hot in the summer or whatever, and humidity, the top of the grain would get kind of dampish, you know. But anyway, not dampish, but I mean it would be, the moisture content would be greater at times than others. So you'd have to make sure that the surface was worked up so that the air could go through. But if it didn't grade what you bought it for at unload, then you took the loss.
Does how long does grain last in storage? Let's say if under normal conditions.
Oh, years.
So as long as it's well, you know, the bugs don't get in,
yeah.
And that.
Oh yeah, for sure, years.
Did you ever clear out an elevator,
or totally. Was it? Mm-hmm. Not to my knowledge, and we always had grain in our elevators for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the 50s was a time when there was lots.
That was a bad time. Yeah, there's grain stored all over the place.
Right, they're building big storage areas in Thunder Bay at that time. Huge storage areas.
But in later years, in Limbaugh, of course, that the system has changed dramatically since that time. Mm. But it was an earning for the grain companies if they were able to keep the grain in good condition.
So back to your, you were at the Qu'Appelle elevator,
yes.
And then you became...
Well, we moved to Winnipeg 4 years after that. We moved to Winnipeg and I was a district manager.
Mm-hmm. What would you say the biggest changes were? Other than a much bigger city, the biggest change is dealing with the Winnipeg area.
Well, the idea is you had one elevator to look after when you were buying grain, and of course you're responsible for all your managers to buy the grain. And we had 25 locations when I took over here in the Winnipeg area. Mm. So it was a matter of making sure that they were buying it properly.
How do you not buy grain properly?
Well, misgrade. Yeah, misgrade. There were a lot of times when, particularly when I moved here, there was a few stations that they had bought grain. It had frost, you know, that the year before they had frost too, and it was coming into the elevators. It was in the elevators, and some of the fellows weren't just up to grading frosted grain. And, you know, if they would, they could grade it at one grade, and it certainly wasn't that grade that you'd take a big loss. And I found that out when I got here.
What kind of training did the elevator staff have for their being able to recognize things like frost damage?
Well, we'd have, you know, generally when we took people into the grain trade, young people starting out, we'd have somebody train them, like the elevator agent themselves. They would be as an assistant, and he'd get his training from the grain buyer. And of course, the grain buyer would get help from other areas too, like our grading department in Winnipeg.
So Patterson had its own grading department.
Yes, we did.
That head office.
Yep.
Was that pretty standard for the companies?
Standard for all companies.
So what were some of the towns that you were responsible for as the Winnipeg?
Oh, down north here, we had 25 stations. Let's see, we've got Toulon and Balmoral, and later years, of course, Arbrook wasn't there at the time, but there was Meadows and Marquette, Dakota, LaSalle, Colross, Fannisdale, Elm Creek, Holland, Cypress River, and then we come down Somerset, Swan Lake, Kane, Morris, St. Jean, Emerson, Dewfrost, Ridgeville. I don't know.
Maybe that's all of them, right?
Yeah, that's quite a few of them anyway.
And that's a pretty big territory.
Well, yes, it was about 100 miles west and to Morris, St. Jean. Did I mention St. Jean? Emerson, St. Jean?
Emerson, I think St. Jean.
St. Jean,
yeah.
It's in there, but it was to the border here, 70 miles or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you had to. And every year, of course, not every year, but as soon as you could, avail yourself to the right time, timing of space within an elevator, which yet again was a requirement of the Canadian Grain Commission that you weigh all your grain in your elevators. I think you knew that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was another job of a district manager to go in there and weigh all that grain. And sometimes you could weigh most of it, sometimes not. Anybody that had these flat annexes, well, the space was so acute that you couldn't bring it all in and weigh it anyway. Mm-hmm. So you'd measure it and get samples of the grain, and hopefully most of the time we'd try to weigh the grain out in the bins so that we'd have a record of it before.
Right.
And then we would weigh the grain in the elevator and what we call permanent annexes. You could auger the grain in to weigh it and then auger it back out.
What kind of annexes were those?
Permanent. They call them permanent annexes.
As opposed to?
Flat storage.
Or temporary annexes. That's interesting, because in that book I was talking to you about, he talked about temporary annexes, and I thought, gee, they're building an awful lot of temporary annexes. Were they really? They didn't mean that the annex was temporary. They meant the storage in the annex was temporary.
Well, yes. I think perhaps maybe it could relate to both versions. They were temporary because we thought, you know, we built them to store the grain and hopefully to get rid of it. And after that, you wouldn't need them, but it was, they were there for years and years and years.
They just became one of the sites, but not the desirable one.
The desirable ones, no. Mm-hmm. We had quite a few in the Patterson organization, what they call permanent annexes, where you run your grain into these bins, several bins. They maybe have upwards to 10 or 12 bins, and then you could bring it in with an auger and put it out with an auger too, of course.
Now, when you moved into Winnipeg then, did you become more familiar, maybe you already were quite familiar, with what happened sort of east of here? shipping down to Thunder Bay?
Yeah, Patterson's, of course, they had a terminal down there. And I was quite familiar with what was going on.
Did you ever visit Thunder Bay?
Yes.
And do you remember the first time you saw the Patterson elevator there?
Well, you just look at it, of course, you know it's there, eh? They had the one terminal, and they had the, I don't know whether they call it the synagogue or whatever, that was a big annex beside it, eh? But, I was familiar with their operations.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the grain would come there and they'd clean it. Every company would like to send their grain to their own terminal, but in later years, of course, they had to take an allocation of the grain that was shipped to Thunder Bay, and it would be divided between the various terminals out there.
Hmm. What was your first reaction to the elevator itself, the terminal elevator?
Oh, well,
anything you recall?
It was something of a bigger nature, of course, eh? Yeah. But, of course, you'd get familiar with these things by looking at pictures and reading and whatever. And it wasn't a big surprise.
Mm-hmm. What was, I don't even know if it's possible for you to answer this question, because there may not be such a thing as a typical day, but when you were the Winnipeg district manager, what would a typical day be like?
You'd go out there, and of course you'd set yourself out an itinerary, and hopefully that you could fulfill it. You'd go from one station to the other, and of course you'd go through their books and you'd talk to the manager about his family, about the business, the people in the community or whatever. That wasn't on every visit, but you'd go through the routine of making sure that things were proper. You might take a sample of the grain that they were buying, pull a hopper full of grain, and just check it to see whether he was doing properly. And of course, then certain stations had, they were payees, I guess you'd payees for, if a farmer delivered grain, they had safes in their elevator, they had cash. And a farmer wanted to get cash for the grain he delivered, well, the manager would make out a cash ticket and then he would turn it into the manager for cash. But on occasion, you would perhaps count the cash to see if it was all there.
Mm-hmm.
The Affiliated Inspection Bureau, which is a subsidiary of the Grain Insurance and Guarantee, they had insurance in all elevators, and of course, and they would send their men out, and they would check the cash as well.
They do a more intensive audit of the financial side of it.
Financial side of it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they went, mind you, their inspectors were actually to make sure that you were living up to fire standards. But that they would also check the cash, of course, when they were going through. We didn't have that at every station, but there was a few of them had it.
Mm-hmm. What kind of challenges did you have to deal with in that position? What would you say would be tough things you had to do?
Well, overall, you wanted the operations to go smoothly, and of course, the more grain you handled, the more money you'd make, and of course, that was a challenge every day you went out to make sure that the managers were attuned to what was going on in the community, and find out if there were any problems with any farmers or whatever. I mean, the thing is to get along with them and do the best you can.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you have to kind of persuade them and work with them. You wouldn't want to be somebody that was just being out there as a boss. You'd have to be a
that would be one the kiss of death. I would
one
think.
Of them.
Yes, and you were.
Well, certainly
because you came up through that system.
Yeah.
Seeing those 25, I think you were saying, 25 communities. So you would really see quite a difference in how the operations operated. So there would be more successful ones and less successful ones, I would think, if that was
Yeah, you could only expect so much of a certain community. Some people had, or some stations had, more accessibility to more grain, better land in the community, and probably maybe they grew better crops. And you know, there was a variety of things that you had to take into consideration. And you know, you just couldn't say, well, you're not doing a good enough job, you're not handling enough grain. Well, you just couldn't do it. Eh? Mm-hmm.
So how would you get that knowledge? Because, you know, there could be, just thinking about it, those are really important considerations, because you can't expect someone, you know, in the Paw, for example, running an elevator out of there to get the same kind of crop yield that you would get down in Kane, let's say. But
Kane was another one, yeah.
Yeah. So how would you, like, you would rely on your elevator operators to say, this is what we can expect for business here, even if we had all of it, we were only going to be able to do so well.
You'd take a survey of how much grain was growing in the area by looking at the permit books and calculating the number of acres seeded to wheat, oats, durum, barley, whatever, and then you'd figure out the average yield, and then you'd say this is what can be expected within the, you know, in that particular area. And you know, by and large, you know, we'd say, well, all right, we have 2% of the total volume of grain in Western Canada. So we'd say, all right, 2%. Well, we should get so much. But here again, some people handled a lot more than 2%. But the average, like I say, was, I think, about 2-3% at the time. But mm-hmm. So you'd strive to do your best to get as much as you could. And of course, there were so many roadblocks in the area, and you couldn't, like I told you, you couldn't get cars. And how are you going to improve your business? First thing you know, your customer is going to someplace else. Mm-hmm. Just because, of course, of the lack of space.
From seeing all of your elevator managers, what would you say would be the predictors that somebody's going to be very good at the job versus some that just manage?
There was a variation, of course. Some were better than others, mm-hmm. of course. And consequently, they got paid better than others, too. I mean, it was, some guys, they just, well, maybe they didn't put out 100%, and yet, and some people that didn't handle maybe their proportionate number of bushels or whatever it was, you know, you have to take into consideration, you know, how difficult it would be for them to, you know, succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you have to take a lot of things into consideration.
Yeah. And the ones who succeeded, even in, let's say, sort of over exceeded even your expectations, given that you know what they were.
Well, we had a bonus deal in the fall of the year. Okay. And, you know, at the end of the crop year, we had a bonus deal, and we would rate our managers. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole workshop from 1 to 10.
Mm-hmm. So no particular qualities in the person that sort of they were going to do a better job.
You have to take everything into consideration. Mm-hmm. You know, how difficult it would be for that manager to have that handle much more grain.
Yeah.
And you know, there were circumstances where quota systems and whatever, mm-hmm. maybe some areas that would be froze out or drowned out or something, they couldn't handle the grain, right. wasn't there.
Yeah.
So you had to take everything into consideration.
Did you ever have to let anybody go?
Yes.
Hmm. What kinds of things led to that?
Well,
many?
No. This at one location, of course, when I first came into Manitoba and I was on the road, and we the district manager that was going into the office, he took me around the territory, and we got into this one location, and apparently the guy was getting dried out in a hospital. So eventually, when that was parcel of my first responsibility, and but anyway, I had to let him go.
personnel issues that come up in every business.
Oh, don't they ever? Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and other areas, they had about a couple, mm-hmm. 2-3 go.
Now,
which wasn't a pleasant thing, but
I'm sure
it was business.
Yeah, well, that's the tough part of management.
That's the tough part of management.
Mm-hmm. So that district manager position, then I think you moved on from that, correct? If I understood you were the district manager for what length of time?
Well, from, I guess the 1st of January 1958, and then I went into the office 4 years after that, and I guess 62.
Hmm. And how did your responsibilities change then?
Well, I got into the office, and I guess I was kind of a general gopher, learning at the time, in the grading room, knowing what that was all about there. Of course, I knew that from traveling. He used to come in every Saturday. We used to work 6.5 days a week. You know, come in on Saturday and go into the grading room and do a lot of things in there. And then, of course, when I got into the office, I had generalized right through the office to know what each department was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, I guess it was about a year, I became assistant to the general manager.
You moved up the system pretty fast.
Moved up
then.
The system then. You know,
very fast.
Very fast.
Yeah. 6.5 day a week. When?
Well, we used to
when
go.
When did that end?
We used to go, like, travel for 5 days. Saturday morning, we'd go into the office, spend another half a day in the office. So you'd have Sunday and a half a day Saturday.
Mm. Oh. So you were on the road with the previous position. You were on the road every week then, or pretty much?
Every week, put there. Yep.
Wow. That's not an easy life either.
No, it's not an easy life.
Mm.
Particularly when you had to take inventory at all these locations. And, you know, they'd like to have every station being weighed over every year, eh? So that was a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. And what was accommodation like for you? Like, a lot of those places wouldn't have hotels or...
Well, some of them didn't. Mm-hmm. For example, well, of course, to Winnipeg, you'd come home all the time, mm-hmm. you know, from these closer locations. But if you get out in the country a bit, like, say, for example, in Haywood, Manitoba, which is down on, that was one of our locations, too. You go to St. Claude, because they had a hotel there. And good water, you could have a shower or something, because that was good. But most of them had accommodations. Not, I shouldn't say most of them. Like Dewfrost, out here, out south, you'd go to Morris for the night or something. St. Mm-hmm. Jean.
You were never very far from.
No.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So assistant to the.
General manager.
General manager. So what is entailed in that job?
Well, again, he was responsible. He was responsible for the outcome of what was happening at every location over the total line.
Who was the person in that position when you first started as the assistant?
Oh, he was Mr. Russ Livesley. Yeah.
And what can you tell me about Mr. Livesley?
Well, he was...
What was his background?
His background?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he came up from Beunder Grinbier at one time. I believe one time he had a store, kind of a store, I think, in Lena, Manitoba or something. I'm not too sure. I think it was Lena, Manitoba. And then he went from there into the grain business as a district manager, and he went back into the office just the way I planned,
mm-hmm,
him, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. So he was responsible for all of the Patterson elevators in the country?
That's right.
In the countryside.
That's right, and he was accountable he was the general superintendent. That's what his job was, general superintendent. And then he had to be accountable to the manager, which was Barry Knight at the time.
Of country elevators, the manager of country elevators, or the manager of
he was the manager
whole company.
He would be the manager of country elevators at the time. The Russ Livesley. I'm sorry. Yeah. And then he'd be accountable to the general manager.
Mm-hmm. So being an assistant to him, did your life change very much from being the district manager? Or just your travels took you further away?
Well, like I said, I was a gopher. I was doing everything, you know. And of course, I had to know what was going on at every location throughout the line then, of course.
How many country elevators, approximately? I mean, I know, well, I won't ask you to name them.
No, I wouldn't. I could name a lot of them, but no, I think probably when I started, I think we had close to 100 or 98 or something of that nature.
How far west did they go?
We went as far, when I started, they were as far as Hilda, Alberta.
Hmm.
Yeah. And then we had quite a few out in western Saskatchewan.
Were they mostly Manitoba locations?
No, they were split between Saskatchewan and Manitoba.
Okay, and then a few Alberta ones.
And a few, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we had Alberta, we only had one. We had traded various elevators off before I got into the business, but they had several in Alberta at one time.
So when you were in the head office there as assistant, or was there much trading off of elevators at that point, or were things fairly stable during that time period?
No, we were trading elevators when I got in to be the assistant. We were trading elevators. There was a formula for trading elevators. If you handled so much grain at one station and you wanted to trade out of that station with another grain company at another station, you'd look at the amount of grain each handled, and over a period of so many years, you know, every period, and if there was a difference, in potential, then you'd come up with cash.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you take one company off one market and put them into a different market. So that's the way it went. That was just a handshake deal. It's just a verbal deal, mm-hmm. too. Put on paper, but nobody signed it.
Yeah. How does it get initiated?
Well, through meetings with the various head offices, you know, I mean, the grain companies. Sasquicpool, they while they come into the program later on, and they weren't really into the program of if you traded them out of a station that they would pay the difference, mm-hmm. or you would pay them the difference. They weren't involved in that, but you know, they waited for you to get the heck out of a market first. I think that was their potential.
So you decide to sell, and they say, okay,
we'll
buy.
If it become to the point where you weren't making any money at a station, sure, you'd sell. You'd mm-hmm. try to get out of it. And then you would trade with them. You know, you could trade. Maybe they had something, but they were reluctant to trade.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd sooner see somebody get off the market. And if they had to close the station, then they would just close it.
Yes, because most of the time they would be, they would have an awful lot of elevators.
They
would already be in a place that you have an elevator.
That's
so
right.
They're just glad to see you go.
Yeah, down in the Sioux Line, for example, main line, elevators down by Sioux Line would be 6-7 miles apart. They'd have elevators at every location.
Mm. So that's close then.
Well, yeah, right.
What would be more smart, let's say?
Well,
more profitable?
You know, I can't blame them for what they were doing, mm-hmm. because that was business. You know, if they didn't have to do it, why do it?
Mm-hmm.
If you could get take somebody off the market,
mm-hmm.
and improve your own lot,
yeah,
so be it.
So every 10 miles might be a better
setup? On the Sioux Line in Saskatchewan, say, for example, between Weyburn and, say, Yellowgrass, there was Weyburn, and there was McTaggart, there was Brightmoor, and there was Yellowgrass. There was four, and that was within 18 miles.
Mm.
And then there was Ibsen, and then there was Lang, there was Milestone, and then there was Wilcox, there was Rollo, Drinkwater, and you go down the Sioux Line, and they weren't too far apart. But maybe 10, 15 miles would be a better average, but...
Mm-hmm.
Down the Sioux Line, they were scattered all over the place.
And I imagine as grain farms got bigger, there was less need to have the smaller places so close together as trucks became bigger.
Right now, apparently we, you know, when you go down the main line in Saskatchewan, or down number one highway, you'd never know the country anymore, because some of the towns have no elevators at all. They're
mm-hmm.
gone. By whom? Yellowgrass had five elevators. I think there's only one left, and that's the grain growers that, well, they had built a new one since they had dealt with McCabe's at one time. It's a new elevator, but and I don't know what, I think it's just a specialized elevator for handling certain grains or whatever.
Quite a difference.
Oh,
yeah. People get lost a lot now, I understand, in the rural areas because they don't have the elevators to
show them
where they are.
Yeah, they were standout flagpole, for example, in the community. Yeah.
When an elevator was decommissioned and not bought by somebody, what happened then? Were they left standing or?
Whenever the station was just
sort of closed,
abandoned,
up.
Like, yeah. More or less.
Mm-hmm. Was there any requirement to do anything with them?
Generally, they were demolished. Yeah, that's what happened.
Put out for bids for?
Well, nobody would bid on them.
No?
No, once you left the station, nobody would go back into it because there was no need for it. No,
Would it be salvaged?
Well, no, generally not. We'd get a fella in that was demolishing elevators. He'd come in there and blow them up and just haul the stuff out of the nuisance ground and burn it.
Hmm.
Yeah. We had, at one time, we had the CNR and the Waukapa subdivision going southern Manitoba. We lost seven elevators one time because they abandoned the line, the railways. So we lost them. We had to close them all up. And of course, as soon as we were able to get all the grain out of these elevators, we had moved, I guess we moved one annex over to Killarney and one elevator over to Elgin, another one over to Fairfax. From that line, we had movers move them in, but the rest of them were just demolished.
It wouldn't seem to me that moving an elevator would be a very easy thing to do.
No, it wasn't.
What did that look like?
Oh, they just put them on, I don't know how many wheels they'd have on them, you know, tires, wheels, like wheels, and they'd have about maybe 20 or 30 hydraulic jacks that worked in unison to get the elevator straight. And if it went over a slope, well, it would adjust itself.
Oh.
Oh, yeah, we would...
And pull them down the highway?
Whatever. Yeah, down, well, some highways, generally in the country, down country roads. And then you'd have a problem with making arrangements with telephone, hydro, bridges had to be shored up.
And all of that at company expense?
All at company expense. Yeah.
So you had to do some calculations to make sure it was going to be worthwhile.
I was involved in that too, besides. That was an interesting project.
So you want to tell me more about that? Because it's a very unusual project.
Well, no, but you had, like you say, you had to make all the arrangements with the various, people like telephone, hydro, municipalities.
Mm.
You had to have insurance, well, there was a lot. There was a lot involved, of course.
Getting the grain out of them. Were you given at least enough notice to be able to use the track to
out? Yeah, we were able to ship it out on the track before they pulled it out.
At a loss, having to sell off stuff you'd rather not have sold.
We lost the business of all seven stations.
Yeah.
So that was a big loss in itself.
Mm-hmm. And other companies, I guess, were on the line as well.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah,
Manitoba Pool, for example. I guess grain growers were on a couple locations, but, yeah, they...
Were you involved in the negotiations to try to get them not to close the line?
Oh, the meetings were ongoing, but now when they decided, the CNR at that time, to close the line, they would just close it. But the CPR, not CN so much, but the CPR held meetings at various locations. You could put in a brief as to why they shouldn't.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever able to salvage a line that might have otherwise gone, or was it just making you feel a bit better that you had a chance to say something?
Not really. I think probably at times I think maybe they prolonged the abandonment, but it was in the works in a way.
Yeah, the writing was on the wall.
The writing was on the wall.
Mm.
Yeah. You know, that was... Well, of course, that was one of the things, of course, that started the revolution, I guess you'd call it. I mean, with all these grain elevators disappearing and the rail lines, of course, going first, and then the elevators, and farms got bigger.
One of the people that we interviewed, Mr. Douglas, from Cargill, I believe. Anyway, he had this big map of the rail lines and the primary elevators from, you know, earlier days. And then on the other side of the map, he had, you know, maybe 20 years later. And just the difference in the number of lines on the squiggly lines showing the railways on one side versus the other. Very major change, even in my, over the time that I've become more interested in grain.
Well, we had a map in our office at one time. We had, this was years ago too, when I was in there, we had said, well, what happens if the railways start abandoning the various lines? And we had, I think we had about 50-some stations pinpointed in Western Canada.
Mm.
Yeah, this was long, long ago. And it's coming, you know, it's coming into realization now.
Yes, just a little longer, taking a little longer time, I think, than people anticipated. But a lot of these changes were envisioned years before.
Well, certainly. And you know, when one time you had a 15-foot scale or a 20-foot scale in your elevator, and then finally the trucks got, you know, farmers got started buying big trucks, and people were hauling grain with larger trucks, so you had to install larger scales, and, you know, everything, it just kept progressing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the Seaway being an example, too, you know, the ships starting out, you know, it'd be hundreds of ships in that, on the Cam River.
Exactly.
At one time, because the ships were tiny, the elevators initially also were much smaller, and as the ships got bigger, it wasn't just a question of, oh great, we don't have to have so many ships, but then the Seaway's too small, and you have to expand the Seaway.
Well, that was Patterson's, I guess, problem too. They had, I guess, the draft, I guess, the deepness of the water. I guess they could just only load, so they couldn't top up a big ship. So
mm-hmm.
they had to pull it someplace else to, and they, of course, that was one of the problems, I guess, that the, you know, the shipping industry didn't like to, you know, put in a big ship in there and have to move to get it topped up at another
mm-hmm.
elevator.
Yeah, and I think the assistance for dredging disappeared.
Oh yeah, exactly.
So, yeah.
A lot of changes.
A lot of changes. What would you say, well, let's finish with, you were assistant to the manager.
The manager of country operations.
Country operations, and then?
Well, after that, there was a fella that he was looking after the paperwork in our office related to the operations in Thunder Bay.
Mm.
So it's when Mr. Livesley retired and Lorne Patterson took over.
That's Lorne Patterson at Patterson, or
no,
just
no,
the same
just,
name?
Just name. Yeah.
Two T's instead
one
of one.
T,
one T.
T.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
One T. Yeah, same thing. And he took over for, I don't know how many years he was in there, a couple of years or 3 years, but anyway, and he retired and I took over.
As the manager?
What did they call me? I guess general manager, eh?
So this was with the paperwork, you became responsible for the paperwork from Thunder Bay?
No, Thunder Bay was, of course, Thunder Bay was already gone.
Okay, so
when did you
take over the position that Mr.?
Oh, geez, I forget the year. It had to been about 4 years or 5 years before I retired.
Okay, so
years.
That would have made it about. I mean, doesn't have to be precise. I'm just
no,
trying to sort
I don't
of
know, something like that. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So when did their elevator go down? Do you remember? When did they dismantle the Thunder Bay?
You know, I'm not too sure of exactly.
Yeah, I'm not either.
No. I'm not sure.
After, in the 70s maybe, because we moved to Winnipeg in the 70s, and I think it was still there when we moved, so probably around that era. Would that fit with your career there, timing?
But anyway, after I got to be the general manager of the grain division, and they later gave me the assignment of vice president and general manager of the grain division. So I had.
So what were your duties then as the?
Well, there was no. You had to report directly to the Don Patterson. Then there was no general manager as such. You know, you became I became the vice president and general manager of the grain division.
And the other divisions were.
Well, we
feed,
had
shipping. Shipping still around then.
Oh no! Well, I know we had a sales manager, of course, and we had. Person that was under me, he was the manager of country operations, and I had an assistant general manager.
Mm-hmm.
Oh no, he was the assistant of country operations.
Okay,
then he became the manager of country operations,
which you had left.
The,
okay. So when you moved up to that position then, as sort of VP of grain division, what were your duties there? How did they differ from?
Well, you know, we had a construction company too. Our boys built our own elevators, and in the latter years, of course, we had engineers come in, I guess, build the height throughput. After I left, anyway. But we built our own elevators. We had our own construction crew. I was responsible for where we're going to build, what we're going to do. And of course, if we're going to spend a great deal of money, I'd certainly have to go to the president to find out whether I could get the money in the first place. But that was part of the job. And of course, overall, it was just to make sure that the operations were going smoothly. That's it.
Mm-hmm. So, making the decision to build an elevator and build it, that sounds like a pretty major project. So what would be entailed in?
Well, you'd have to take the potential in the area, make sure that the rail line was sound, it was going to stay there. Sometimes it wasn't the right decision, because later on some of the places that we built were traded off to another grain company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as times changed, of course, the whole area of handling grain changed. So it was.
Was the design of those elevators pretty standard? So that, like, did you have special engineering staff, or was it really mainly a construction project?
No, they're more or less standard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no matter throughout the industry. But other than that, like I say, it was just a matter of trying to make it all.
Mm-hmm. How would you take me through sort of the decision making to build? Like, how did you decide that yes, things looked promising here? Besides, making sure that the rail line was stable. What kind of research did you do, or reconnaissance?
Oh, well, we would look after, see if I, initially you'd look the area over as to how many acres there were seated in the area, and what your opposition were doing, and what their percentage of the market would be, and what you expected you could handle at the station. You have to do that, and as a matter of fact, if you were at a station and you were doing quite well and you needed new facilities, well, it's either abandon the station or do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that was a major decision too. So you had a bunch of faithful customers, and so you had turned around. Yeah, you had to take that into consideration.
Mm-hmm. So could you retrofit an old one, or that, just like many buildings today, it's better to just take it down and build a new one?
Well, the older ones, they had small scales, and of course, while we did install larger scales at some locations, that wasn't the end of all. We had to have faster facilities, we perhaps maybe you could elevate a couple of thousand bushels an hour, but then you had to have something that elevated 10,000 bushels an hour, so that to speed up the operation. Hmm. So everything was, and you had to load cars much faster too.
Yes, because hopper cars, I guess, were coming in and.
Oh yeah, certainly, and then of course the system, the railways, they give you some incentive. They give you a couple of bucks or whatever it was. There was a price tag on it if you could have a 25 or 30 car spot, and that was an incentive to
send up more than a couple at a time.
That's right. So you build your facility so that you could at least fulfill the obligations mm-hmm. of loading the cars in a certain length of time, and so many at, you know, in a, mm-hmm. again, in a certain length of time.
Yeah. One of my disappointments in this project was that I didn't get a chance to interview Mr. Don Patterson.
Yeah, he's gone.
Yes.
God bless him.
Yeah. Yes. What can you tell me about him?
Well, what can I say about Don Patterson? Very astute. He was a real gentleman. He, of course, as you probably know, that I guess he was a pilot in the bomber pilot during the war, as was his brother John. He was a fighter pilot operator, I guess. And they spent their time overseas and had their allotted trips and more, I suppose, you know. Yeah, Don was.
What did you admire about his way of running the company?
Well, you know something? He let the people in charge of the industry run it. He would go to him with a proposal as to build an elevator and how much money you're going to spend and everything. He thought perhaps if it was, you know, they had, of course, a board of directors too, and he thought perhaps if it was within the budget and it looked good, fine and dandy, but, you know, he let the personnel of the company run the company.
So he hired good people and then made sure that they...
That's probably maybe what they endeavored to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We've covered an awful lot in your career. How long was it, the total career from the day you started to
his book, the book that Patterson put out? Yeah, you've seen it, I guess.
Yes, I have.
Well,
yeah.
In that book, they say
Rob got me a copy. Yes.
I was 30 years in that book, but I was 37 and a half years.
Well, okay, now we've got it on record.
Well, there you are.
Yeah, we're correct.
Well, it was. I was 37 and a half years with him. But I guess all my, some of the stuff I took out of the office when I left, and I don't know why, I the office manager gave it to me, mm-hmm. and well, I just stuffed it away. I don't know where it is. But anyway, I guess they were just guessing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, 37 and a half years.
Yeah. So when you look back on that career and a very successful one, what are you most proud of?
Most proud of? That I worked with a tremendous company. They were good.
Mm-hmm.
The Pattersons were good.
Yeah, but you did work too, and so out of what you did or accomplished, and it doesn't have to be big; it can be small. Some people who answer this question say, you know, I was most proud of that piece of machinery that I helped design. Or,
well, you know, I was proud in the fact that what I did to the best of my ability, and I got awarded for it. Okay. Can I say?
Well, that's everything then.
Yeah. That's right. They were a tremendous company to work for, and you had something to work for.
You had something to work for?
No, but you were happy to do the things that made the company prosper. Let's mm-hmm. put it that way. That was your ultimate goal.
Yeah, and you're proud of what you did.
Sure,
like, definitely. And what they did.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. You know, yes, for sure.
Mm-hmm. You know what, I'm just going to take a second here to look at my questions, because I think we've covered most of them, even though not in the order that I've got them on the page, but that's usual too. So I just want to see if I've missed anything. Well, this question some people find difficult to answer, but I'll ask you. What might surprise people most about the work you did?
Well, probably surprise them.
Mm-hmm. Like they'd find unusual, or, gee, I never would have thought that, or...
Well, I don't know. I think probably maybe the, you know, I was a no-nonsense person, and I was one of very few words, but I try to express myself in a way that, to get the best out of people, let's put it that way.
That's a pretty important skill as a manager.
Well, yeah, you've got to do it, yeah, somewhere down the road.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time, and I'll take this off the...
Want me to? Sure? Sure, yeah. I need to take it off, or
yeah.
Just remove
take
it from
off.
The... Okay,
no,
just
no,
a second.
Not take it off, just stop it.
Okay, just a sec. I have to think about how to do that so I don't screw things up.
You have
up.
To go back, maybe.
No, I just have to press pause. I'm going back on tape now. I have a couple of questions here. I think we've actually dealt with them, but I just want to give you an opportunity in case there's something else you want to add to what you've said. During that 37 years, what would you say were the biggest changes? The ones that stick in your mind, or the ones that had the most impact?
I think they were gradual. Yeah, they were just a gradual change in the industry. The allocation of cars for shipping of grain, I think maybe the railways disappearing at various locations, and then the building of larger elevators, disposing of smaller elevators and getting rid of certain elevators, and it was just a gradual change in the
mm-hmm.
industry, and I think it was just gradual.
Mm-hmm. Any and I could see why you say that. Any ways of doing business changes? I mean, not the physical, you get rid of the lines and so on. Any changes in the ways of doing business, or even though physical things change, the ways of doing business still pretty much stay the same?
In my time, I suppose, not so much, but I think after I retired, that's when the big changes came about.
How would you describe those changes?
Well, when I retired that fall, or prior to my retirement, I was involved in acquiring rail line and Inhead to build a high throughput elevator, one of Patterson's first high throughputs.
These are the big.
Big
bigger
elevators
yes.
in the
yep.
country, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And that was as far as I went. I went over the design of the elevator with the fellows before I retired, but I said, you know, guys, it's your responsibility. I'm retired. I said, so that was the changes really come after that.
Mm-hmm. What kind, I mean, again, other than physical changes, I'm thinking that one change might be is at one point all of these elevator managers lived in the communities, and these people became their friends. Their customers were their friends.
Oh, I
whereas
yeah,
the
certainly they were well friends. I guess they were
acquaintances.
Some
friends,
yeah,
some acquaintances.
Some friends, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then of course the places got bigger, and they had more people working in each location. They might have had three or four people working in one location, and that made a big change too. Of course, costs went up. Even though they handled a lot more grain, there was more. I guess there was more to do. It involved more people.
Mm-hmm. So management at those elevators even became a bigger
I think
bigger issue.
The electronic issue was a big issue. You know, they had electronic scales and in and out, and they'd get out there and they'd weigh the grain, and immediately the ticket was printed out, and you know there was nobody coming around and say, well, look at, you're stealing from me or anything. But and nobody, that was one thing we emphasized when we had our managers meetings, that said, our fellas, look at, we don't want to take any grain off farmers. We got our shrinkage to look after, and hopefully that'll see us through. And I said, other than that, I said, we don't intend to make, you know, any bad enemies by doing so. And that was our philosophy.
Mm-hmm. No, smart business philosophy, well, a smart human philosophy, well, but a smart business philosophy.
That's right. And we had the Canadian Grain Commission at one time, you know, we had these weigh-overs, and if you had an overage of sorts, we had a couple of guys, I guess, called up one time, and then there was a reason for it. I went out with the members of the Canadian Grain Commission, or the chief inspector. We went out, and it was resolved. And yeah, they'd clean grain for a farmer. The farmer wouldn't want his screenings, for example, eh? So he'd throw it back into stock. And of course, when you chip it out, that would show up, and the end result would be maybe a small overage or whatever. But there was an answer for it. Mm-hmm.
Did you have much dealings in your positions with the Grain Commission? I'm going to turn it back on, just in case you have something to say there. So, significant changes in working conditions, labor relations, advances in science and technology.
Well, you know, one thing about labor relations, Sask-Wheatpool, I think, were the only grain company in Western Canada that had a union. They had a union when I was there, too, at the start. Yes, there was a union. But the other grain companies didn't have a union, and we didn't have a union, and with Patterson's. And, you know, I would think probably of all the fellows that were in the country, I would think maybe only one would maybe opt to have a union. And the guy had no reason in the world to think that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, treated well, paid well, everything. I don't know where he would ever want it to, you know, to further himself.
Mm-hmm. Were salaries pretty competitive, maybe there's the word I want, between companies?
Oh, you had to be. You had to be. Of course, Sask-Wheatpool, they had different working relations, like particularly because they were different than the rest of the grain trade, eh? Let's put it that way. Where we would perhaps have one manager at a station, and if he needed extra help, maybe get it for, you know, part-time help or whatever, and that was it. Sask-Wheatpool might have two guys along with the manager doing the same kind of work as our guys do. But like I said, initially the company provided homes for them. And even though after we had to start paying, charging them rent, it wasn't near what the Sask-Wheatpool were charging. I'm going to Sask-Wheatpool because, again, this is kind of they're a huge grain company, eh, at that time. Well, they still are.
Sort of the benchmark.
Yeah, benchmark. Yeah. So anyway, I think all companies were probably maybe in the same position as what we were. And we used to tell our fellows, look, if you want a day off or whatever, go ahead and do it. If you want to work 10 hours a day, I guess there's regulations in effect, but you know, who's gonna say anything unless you squawk, of course. But they were satisfied just working under the conditions we offered them.
Did most people stay with the companies they started with, like the people working in the rural? You start out in the pool, you, other than in your instance, for example, where they were promising deliver.
Yeah.
Do they, you know, they start in the pool, their career's in the pool, or was there any kind of moving around?
I think by and large they would stay with the company they started with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think there would be any any reason for, if he was treated well, why would he leave? You know, for a company if they were treating him well.
Right.
But for compensation, I think we have to be competitive in salaries. When you took everything into consideration, you know.
Housing and so on.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Working conditions and whatever.
Yeah. What part of the history of the industry through the years that you lived or worked there do you feel is important to preserve and share with the public who are less familiar with that industry?
Go over that again.
What part of the history of the industry do you feel is important to preserve and share with the public? So what do the people need to know about the grain industry? It's the past.
You're not talking about the Canadian Wheat Board or anything like that?
Not in particular, no. I'm just talking about the industry. So if you even just limited it to your own situation, what part would you like people to remember? And the reason I ask this question, a couple of reasons. One, it's unlikely that people will sit and listen to an entire interview, but we will pick bits and pieces, you know, to share. So if you look at your own very, I don't want to say small, but your own place in that history versus the bigger picture, what would you like not to be forgotten? It would be sad if people forgot or never knew.
Well, I think probably they, as it relates to our own company, you know, I'm going to say with Patterson's, that they have been socially conscious of what goes on in the world. Eh? And I'll remember, apparently, you know, one time years ago, and this was given to me. Through word of mouth, but at one time, Senator Patterson, Norman McLeod Patterson, of course, the founder of the company, he was out west one time, you know, on one of his PR trips, and he stopped, I think it was at Kincaid, Saskatchewan, as I recall. But anyway, this was in the winter time or cold weather, anyway, and this young kid came into the elevator office, and apparently he had gunny sacks wrapped around his feet or whatever, you know, it was cold. And what, you know, just why is he wearing the gunny sack? Well, he said to keep his feet warm. You know, well, there was no money. And, of course, shoes, I guess they didn't have quite enough money to buy shoes. And anyway, after that time, the senator initiated a policy that for every employee's wife, when she had a child, she was given $100. And that stayed on throughout the years, and I think it probably is still in effect. And the Patterson, he established a Patterson Foundation, and you probably know more about that, living in Thunder Bay, what he's done for Thunder Bay, because he's done a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that same thing is going forward again with Patterson Global Foods. And just recently, or last fall, I guess, when they had their 100th anniversary here, they had a social event down here in Winnipeg, maybe a couple, two or three of them, but I was at one of them anyway. But they, as you know, the Patterson Global Foods, they gave $1 million to upgrade facilities downtown Winnipeg for students wanting to attend Red River College. And the Patterson Foundation gave $1 million. That's $2 million. And, you know, when you work for a company that socially
aware and responsible.
Aware, yeah, that's right. And you know, that has got to be one of the most outstanding things in my career, to know that I work for a company that has done these great things.
And you'd like that to be known.
Oh yes, exactly.
Yes,
exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we are coming up just past the hour and a half mark.
That long.
It's hard to believe. The time goes so fast. And I think we have some wonderful memories recorded here. And I'd like to thank you very much for taking part in the project.
Well, like I say, I'm one of a very few words, and I never did like public speaking.
Well, I'm glad you're great one-to-one, because otherwise we wouldn't have these memories.
I remember Whittaball, Jim Whittaball, I guess they call him. He used to work for the Canadian Grain Commission. I don't know. He's down here in Winnipeg. And him and I were, we took a public speaking course, I guess, down to Red River College at one time. And he was there too, of course. I think Jim, I forget what his job was down there, but he had a pretty good job anyway. So anyway, I had to introduce him, and he introduced me. But that was quite an experience too. It was good.
Yeah. So you're encouraged to take training and improve your skills and.
Yeah, exactly.
But, yeah. It still wasn't your favorite thing to do.
Like I say, I'm not a public speaker. You know, like to start that program off, if I could have been relaxed about where you were born or what were you doing, you know, that could have come across much better, I'm sure. But,
You never noticed to listen to it.
No,
it was just fun.
You'll strip it out.
So thank you very much. I'm just going to shut the machine off now before I run out of time as well.